This is Walter Edgar's Journal. Today's program is a rebroadcast of a 2013 interview with the late journalist and author Ken Berger, and it is part of our continuing series celebrating Walter Edgar's Journal at 21. With me in the Scana studio today is retired journalist Ken Berger. For many years, he wrote a column for the Post and Courier. He's an Allendale native, and in his retirement, he's pretty young to be retired. He's also started writing novels. And we're going to just chat about a lot of things because you can take the boy out of Allendale, but you can't take the Allendale out of the boy. So,
Patrick.
Ken, welcome to the Journal.
Thank you, Walter. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk first about your collection of columns, Baptized in Sweet Tea. Why the title?
The title, actually the book came from, it's, for those who don't know, it's a, like a coffee table book. It's a collection of columns that I've written over the years about growing up and living in the South, and South Carolina in particular. We came to do this about the time I was retiring from the Post and Courier in Charleston, and one of my editors said, well, it'd be nice to put a collection together. And Evening Post Books, which is a division of the Post and Courier, Evening Post Company, published it. And basically, I went back and pulled some columns that I'd done over the last few years about South Carolina, a lot of nostalgic stuff. And the line, Baptized in Sweet Tea, I had used in a column a few years ago. I was talking about growing up in Allendale and what it was like. And I said that we attended Swallow Savannah Methodist Church, that my mother poured grape juice into the communion glasses, my father sang in the choir, and I was baptized in sweet tea. It was a good line for the day. And when I came across it, I just thought it'd be a nice title for a book.
One of the things that runs throughout the book is, you know, I guess maybe you're proving Thomas Wolfe is wrong because you do go home.
I do go home. People are amazed when I tell them that. Of course, I was born and raised in South Carolina, in Allendale, which is, for those who don't know, is a very small town in the southwest corner of the state down on the Savannah River. And in a typical small town South Carolina way, I grew up in an incubator with a circle of friends that we all grew up from birth until we graduated from high school. So I still have very close friends that we get together several times a year. And, you know, they're now 60-year friends, and we play golf, and we hang out for a few days a couple of times a year. And other people from other places are just astounded that you're still that close with people you grew up with. But when you have that close a relationship in such a small town, we all are marked by the same experiences, and you carry that all the way through life.
Well, I think it's interesting that so many of them remained in small towns, because in a lot of small towns, South Carolina, folks, when they went to high school, like you, they went off,
right,
but they never came back.
Right. Well, only a few of us still live in Allendale. Most of us live in other parts of the state, but a couple of guys are still around. Allendale, you know, suffered like many small towns. And I wrote in one of my columns that I grew up in the hyphenated conference, and it was Allendale, Fairfax, Williston, Elko, Bamberg, Earhart, Denmark, Oler, all these small towns.
Consolidated schools.
And high schools, too. And we played, you know, in Class B football. We were so small. It's an interesting part of the world. Unfortunately, our main street was U.S. Highway 301.
And Interstate 95 killed 301.
Right. U.S. 301 was the main route from New York to Miami and back for all our northern friends. And I worked as a bellhop at the Allendale Motor Court when I was a kid, and used to come home with a pocket full of quarters. And they would fill up by dark during the migration, we called it. They went south in the winter and came back through going north in the summer. So, but that 95, I-95 opened up 40 miles away, 40, 50 miles away, and that killed it. Plus, shortly after that, the farmers went through tough times, and a lot of them lost their farms. So the town that I grew up in physically is still there, but it's not quite the same as it was. And unfortunately, we got a lot of places like Allendale in South Carolina. One of the things I tell people when I talk is that they say, what are we going to do about these towns? Well, the main thing you could do is give them an economy, which many of them don't have. Now, the new world, for places like Allendale and many small towns that are in these depressed pockets of our state, it could be ecotourism. The Savannah River is one of the prettiest stretches of river from Augusta to Savannah that you'll ever see, and is very little own it. I mean, you can get in, and we do this. We go camping on there every October, and you can get in a boat and ride for an hour and not see anything, anybody. So it's a really pristine area that has been preserved by a lot of the plantations have been turned into nature preserves or pine plantations, really. And it's a really beautiful part of the state. So I think its future may lie in ecotourism. And also, now that in this internet world, who knows? Who knows what the future might be for some of these places that they can reach out over the pine trees now and get some attention.
Well, you know, Ken, that's interesting because when I speak around the state, go to civic clubs in small town, they'll say, how can we become the next Newberry? You know, places like Newberry are pretty exceptional. They also happen to be close to the interstate.
That's right. They have an exit off the interstate.
But I can remember, he wasn't really an Allendale boy, although that became his adopted home, Bob McNair.
Oh, of course.
After he stepped down as governor, he would go try to help economic development. And towards the end of his life, I remember him going to several small counties, and he said, the leadership that used to be there isn't there.
Right.
It's absentee landlords.
Right.
And so it's to try to gin up an economy, it's not as easy as people think it might be.
No, it's a bit of a Rubik's Cube economically. You know, people say, well, if we could get industry into these places, they could have an economy, but then how do you get people to come live there when you don't have a movie theater, your schools are not are subpar, and there's really nothing to do unless you hunt deer. there's not a lot to do down there.
Well, and that's true in a lot of places.
Not just
Allendale.
And not just South Carolina.
No, oh, absolutely. Yeah. Not. I mean, there are places that are in worse straits than Allendale. Go to pockets of West Virginia,
right,
or Oklahoma,
right,
or actually you can go to upstate New York.
Right. I think eventually what might save an area like Allendale is that there's always been a need, I thought, for a road, an interstate, to go from Charleston to Atlanta through Augusta to cut that corner of the state.
Oh,
because it's really, really isolated down there because of the bomb plant. In my books, I write about the Savannah River plant, which was my next-door neighbor growing up, and it was the big top-secret boogeyman of the times because that's where they made plutonium. It was the worst-kept secret, a top secret in the state, what they did. But that corner, because the Savannah River plant, a lot of people don't realize, is 300 square miles of land that they came in and took, really, right after World War II to produce this Savannah River plant to produce plutonium. And it's a large swath that really isolates that corner of the state. And what they really need is traffic through there, some kind of economic interest to come through there. But, you know, it's not my problem to solve. I wish I could.
It's interesting. I heard the late Senator Strom Thurmond talk about, you know, we really do need an interstate. Of course, he was talking about from Aiken to Charleston.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, cutting that corner.
Right. So there's really no reason for anybody to go there.
Yeah.
Unless they're, you know, cutting. And it's a beautiful area to drive through. But part of what I write about in Baptizing Sweet Tea, a lot of these columns harken back to, you know, the days of screen porches and the days when people would live a different, slower life. And that's what Baptizing Sweet Tea is all about. And what I found, I thought this would appeal to, you know, people like me who grew up here. But we've sold so many of these books now that
you're your third or fourth printing?
This third printing on Baptizing Sweet Tea. And I hear from people all over, and even the people from up north in the Midwest, they say, well, you know, you don't have to be from the South to appreciate this because a small town is a small town. There's one in there that the title is Being Raised by 100 Mothers.
Well, that was exactly what I was getting to. Back in the 1990s, when Hillary Clinton wrote her book, you know, It Takes a Village, and everybody poo-pooed that, I thought, wait a minute, how can any Southerner,
right,
white or black, talk about not being raised by a community? Even growing up in a big town like Mobile, if I made a misstep in a town, somebody either called my mother or my grandmother.
And right. Right. Well, you can imagine what it's like in Allendale.
In Allendale.
And interestingly, and I mentioned in that column that's in there about that it crossed color lines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were a lot of black women who helped raise me, whether they were in my home or whether it was just across town and I was doing something I wasn't supposed to be doing. My mother and father would hear about it before the sun went down.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just the nature of a small town. And it's great. I mean, it really is. They had permission to punish. Which is on the spot, which is a great thing.
Now I'm afraid if somebody grabs somebody's child to punish, There'd be three lawyers.
Right. And, Yeah. It wasn't like that then.
No.
They could tear you up and send you home, and then they'd tear you up again.
This is Walter Edgar's Journal. Today's program is a rebroadcast of a 2013 interview with the late journalist and author Ken Berger, and it is part of our continuing series celebrating Walter Edgar's Journal at 21.
Well, one of the things I found interesting about the publicity for your book is you're pretty honest about your past.
Oh, yeah.
Not many folks, particularly Southern boys, talk about being married five times.
Right. Can I read you this one paragraph?
Yeah.
Actually, when we were doing my first novel, the people who were putting it together, they said, you know, we have a bio for you on the book. And I read it, and it was pretty boring. It was about winning awards and all this stuff. And I said, well, that's pretty boring. Let me write you a paragraph. And I wrote that last paragraph that says, born and raised in Allendale, South Carolina, Berger graduated dead last in his class at the University of Georgia, has been married five times, is a gratefully recovering alcoholic, a cancer survivor, and a happy man.
Okay.
That paragraph has sold more books than I have.
Well, one of the things not clear, are you married now?
I am.
Okay. So number five stuck.
To number five. We've been married. We're going on 7 years. Bonnie Grossman is my wife. And she's just retired as a professor at the College of Charleston. I call her the love of my life. My friends call her the incumbent. But we're doing great. Thank you.
Are you for sure last in your class?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. The short version of that, Walter, is I was a terrible student. It goes along with that other part in there that I'm a gratefully recovering alcoholic. Mm-hmm. I quit drinking when I was 30 years old. Mm-hmm. That was 32, 33 years ago. But when I was in college, I was a terrible student. I was a good writer. You know, I was in journalism school at the University of Georgia, but I just wasn't a good student. So I did actually flunk out during the Vietnam War, which is a really smart thing to do. I got in the South Carolina Air National Guard, served my active duty time. I was readmitted to the University of Georgia on double secret probation. They let me back in. But a short version is I had to pull my GPA up from a 1 point something to a 2.0 to get the minimum to graduate. And I did, and I hit it right on the head. Actually, I think they fudged me a little bit. And I finished dead last.
Well,
couldn't have been anybody under me.
but you got your degree, and then you actually came to work here in Columbia.
I did, right next door here. In 1973, I was in danger of graduation, and I thought I better look for a job. And I stopped the state paper. Doug Nye, who I know you know.
I know
Doug. He's a friend of ETV for many years. Unfortunately, he passed away. And Doug Nye hired me, and we spent 30 years trying to figure out why, because I was not a great catch coming out of college. But the bottom line, this is what Doug taught me very early. I told him, he hired me as a sports writer for the Columbia Record. And I told him, I said, I'm really not a sports writer, and I'm not even a sports fan, really. I don't know who's in the American League and who's in the National League. I just haven't been paying attention. And he said, that's okay. He said, sports is what you cover. Writing is what you do for a living. And he said, I like the way you write. So he hired me, and I spent 6 great years working for him at the Columbia Record before I moved over to the state.
And for folks who are new to South Carolina, the Columbia Record was the evening paper.
Yes, yes, the afternoon paper.
In Columbia.
It was the little sister.
Yeah. High school football, or did you cover everything?
I covered everything. I started out, everybody back then, I guess we still do really, starts out your first year, you cover high school. And then I moved up to covering Carolina and Clemson. And then I wrote a column a bit. Doug really let me do a lot of stuff. And we traveled so much back then. Herman Helms was the sports editor of the state. We actually had the state record company had its own plane back then. And we used to go to all these games on a private plane. We didn't even have to go through the airports to do commercial. So it was really a different time in newspapers. But I had a 37-year career in newspapers here in South Carolina at the Columbia Record, the State, and the Post and Courier, which was the News and Courier when I got there in 84. And I was fortunate, really fortunate, to be in the right place at the right time. I was part of that move that the Charleston paper, when I went there, it was the worst paper in the state.
Well, people used to locals used to call it the newsless
Absolutely.
Courier.
Absolutely, and I knew it. I was there by a circumstance after a first divorce, and I needed a place to be. And I was in the right place at the right time. And that paper went from being the worst in the state to, I think, the best in the state, and also the largest now in the state by the time I retired. So it was quite a ride.
And when did you start writing your column?
Oh, which one? I started writing, I actually go back to 1985, 87. I was a Washington correspondent for our paper. The Charleston paper sent me to Washington for 2 years to live in Washington and cover our delegation and whatever else I wanted to write about. So from 85 to 87, I covered the news. Well, then I wrote a Sunday op-ed column that became pretty popular. And I tell people now that my real job up there was that of interpreter, because I was in the Senate Press Gallery every day. I knew all the writers from the New York Times to the, you know, L.A. Times and Chicago Tribune were all around me elbow to elbow. But whenever Strom, Thurman, or Fritz Hollings opened their mouth, all these guys would turn to me and go, what the hell did he say? They couldn't understand it. So it was a great time. And so I wrote that column for 2 years. I came back to Charleston, and without a plan, I ended up back in sports after being away from sports for like 9 years. And it was an opportunity to write a column. I thought I would do it for a couple of years and then go back to news. But it was so much fun that I did it for 21 years. And I had a ball. We went. It was a great time to be a sports columnist in America because newspapers were making money. They made a lot of money. We spent a lot of money and traveled. I went to Super Bowls and Masters and Final Fours and everywhere. It was a great time.
But then you moved from sports column to just general.
I did.
I guess we call it general interest column.
Yeah, metro column is what we called it. The last few years of my career, I got out of sports because I really was tired of the road. I would spend more than 100 nights a year in hotel rooms. And that has part to do with those five marriages.
I was going to say that.
But people ask me about being married five times, and I say, well, you know, it turns out there's no limit in South Carolina. It's not like deer hunting, you know. But I moved. The folks at the paper were kind enough. When I decided I'd really been on the road enough, they allowed me to move back to news, where I wrote a metro column about whatever I wanted to write for 3 or 4 years before I retired. And that was four columns a week. So I've really had a great run.
Well, speaking of columns, why don't you pick out one of your favorites and read it for us?
Can I read you one that I know you would go with? It's called Our State is One Big Small Town. If I might read this real quick. They're all 500 words because my column ran down the left-hand side of the page, and it couldn't go more than 500 words. So all of them are good length. And it goes like this. If you grew up in the Palmetto State, you know that South Carolina is a collection of small towns connected by country roads, family ties, and stories, true or false, passed along between friends and foes. When you're young, of course, your corner of the world is the entire world as far as you're concerned. Mine was the swampy swallows along the Savannah River in the southwestern part of the state, an area dotted with towns that pretty much peaked in the 1960s. I often say we competed in the hyphenated conference because all the schools had names like Allendale Fairfax, Denmarkola, Williston Elko, Bamberg Earhart, and Blackville Hilda. Some, like Langley Bath Clearwater and Hunter Conard Tyler, actually required two hyphens. Once you grew up, went off to school, got a job, and a grip on how diverse our lovely state really is, you came to understand that it's all interconnected by old family loyalties, fraternity friends, sorority sisters, ex-wives, former brothers-in-law, business relations, beach houses, river trips, political enemies, Civil War stories, and things that make us all distant cousins in this dysfunctional family with tree roots that run from the mountains to the sea. If you're from Charleston, for instance, you probably have relatives in Newberry, perhaps a college roommate from Myrtle Beach, a former girlfriend from Florence, an old drinking buddy from Anderson, a cousin or two from Beaufort, and a friend with a hunting lodge outside Saluda. People who went to Clemson have a friendly dislike for people who went to South Carolina, but they all know folks who once grew tobacco in Pamplico, some who worked at the bomb plant outside Aiken, others who grew up in Gaffney, and a few who never left Aner. Through marriages, divorces, dove shoots, land disputes, house parties, boys' state, military schools, lawsuits, family reunions, summer jobs, business mergers, and midnight drag races, we're all just one question away from knowing somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody you know. you probably had conversations that begin with, if you're from Blacksburg, you probably know that sorry son of a gun so-and-so. That's usually followed by a remark like, well, I didn't know him, but his brother from Spartanburg was good friends with my uncle from Cross Anchor, who married one of those twins from Andrews, who turned out to be first cousins with my sister's maid of honor in her first wedding to a guy named Bubba from Bamberg, who ended up going to jail for shooting a shrimper from Frogmore because he didn't pay up on a bet that he could hypnotize a chicken. Truth is, if you can diagram that sentence for better or worse, you're a genuine South Carolinian.
Absolutely.
You've had those conversations. There are a lot of these in here that I really like. I wanted to read you one if you've got time.
Well, I have only one thing with which I'll disagree with the column that you wrote.
Right.
And that has to do with seersucker
suits.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, seersucker suits.
Because you say in the Palmetto State, we stretch the calendar out a little bit longer after Labor Day, allowing them until the first leaf falls in October. Maybe, maybe not.
I go to Halloween. That's Charleston now.
Well, even in Charleston, they tend to, most folks that I know abide by
them. They do. I'm an outlier.
Yeah, but, you know, given the practicality of the climate these days.
Yes. I haven't put my seersucker suits in the attic yet.
Miss Neal and I are serious about
pretty strict about that.
Pretty strict about that.
There you go. Well, I'm an outlier on that. Can I read you one about cars?
Sure.
Oh, this is one of my favorites. If you grew up back when we grew up.
And I got to tell our listeners.
Yes.
There are great photographs about this book. And this is a 57 Chevy.
Absolutely.
That, you know.
Everybody knows.
Talk about a cool car.
Yeah.
Boy, did General Motors screw up the next year with those 58s that have the
oh, I know. The little. Curve. I just saw one yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we used to know cars. You know, we knew. We waited for the new models to come out. We would go down to the dealership and peek under the covers that they had on them to see what the new models are going to be like. That was a very exciting time. I don't want to forget to mention that this book, like you say, is I tell people it takes a lot of guts to try to sell people a book with things that you've already printed in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. So it's a coffee table book. Pictures are all done by my friend David Gentry. This is his first time being published. He's a professor at the College of Charleston and a friend of ours, and I asked him to do this, and he did a wonderful, beautiful job. So this one's under the subhead of Boys Will Be Boys. It's called Hot Cars and Hot Summers, and it goes like this. I come from an age when cars had bucket seats, stick shifts, double-barrel carburetors, and no air conditioning. Those were the days when cooling the inside of an automobile robbed horsepower from those mighty mills that hurled us like rockets through the muggy nights of South Carolina summers. I grew up when cars were more than transportation. They were symbols of a society possessed with power, when speed limits were subtle suggestions, when seatbelts were for sissies, and nobody ever got arrested for driving under the influence of obsession. Those were the days when cars had names like GTO, Sport Fury, Roadrunner, Challenger, Firebird, Trans Am, Charger, and Hemi. It was an era of cheap gas, hood scoops, lake pipes, speed shifting, drag racing, mag wheels, and growling guttural sounds that would wake you up in the middle of the night and make you want to leave home. Today, people consider doing 80 on the interstate, pushing the limits, and they're right. Speed kills. We have the statistics and the cemeteries to prove it. How we survived the 1960s while roaring down those dark, rural, narrow, farm-to-market roads is a miracle that can only be explained by God's soft spot for fools. But speed was a fact of life and death in those days. It was glorified in the manufacture of muscle cars and elevated to a sport on racetracks around the South, where our heroes spun their way through catastrophic crashes and walked away, lit up a cigarette, and kissed the beauty queen. Such were role models in those devil-may-care days. I remember one summer night, high on humidity, when we were driving faster than our headlights could pierce the darkness. When telephone poles flew by like fence posts, the driver had one hand on the gear shift, was using the other to light up a smoke, the speedometer was pegged, and we were still accelerating. With all the insight of a 16-year-old, I thought I was finally living, when in reality, I was a deer's breath from dying. Having survived such a reckless youth, I now drive with both hands on the wheel, reasonably close to the speed limit, seatbelt securely fastened, eyes on my mirrors, scanning all directions for somebody who looks like me when I didn't know better. But I must admit, when a hot car rumbles by, I still want to roll down the windows, let my hair catch the rushing wind, and leave the air-conditioned airbag world of modern cars in the dust.
Well, I was just thinking about those seats. You either had the sort of plush or you had what was even worse was those plastic seats.
Oh, yeah.
You could slide across them, but gosh, in the summertime.
I know. It's sticky. It's sticky. You stick to them. I remember those. And, you know, we didn't really have the leather like we have now, yeah. You know, in cars. It was quite a different experience. But they were mostly motor. They were style and power.
And the fact that they weren't bucket seats, they were benches
right.
all the way across, and no seat belts, and you could pile as many people as you wanted to into the car.
Exactly. You know, those were the days. And it was an interesting time. And many as you could get in the trunk if you went to a drive-in movie. So
yeah, because you paid by the car.
Exactly right.
This is Walter Edgar's Journal. Today's program is a rebroadcast of a 2013 interview with the late journalist and author Ken Berger. And it is part of our continuing series celebrating Walter Edgar's Journal at 21.
I've done a couple of novels that they're all South Carolina stories. I wrote the first one, Walter, before I retired from the paper, and it's called Swallow Savannah. Swallow Savannah is an unusual name. I always have to explain it to people. It was the name of the Methodist, and still is, the name of the Methodist Church in Allendale that I grew up in. It's where the title came from, baptized in sweet tea, about going to that church.
Well, let me just ask you about that. Because
sure.
How is that little church hanging on? Because I know a lot of small sure. country churches have really had some hard times.
Yes, they have. I think all these churches in small towns are suffering. When Swallow Savannah was published in 2009, I believe, I went back to Allendale as soon as it was published. I told Bonnie, I said, I need to go explain to these people that I grew up with about this book that has the name of the church on it. So we went back on a Sunday morning, and I walked into Swallow Savannah Methodist Church, where I had gone my entire time growing up. And I walked in, and the people I knew were still sitting in the same seats they were sitting in when I left in 1967, just not as many of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they didn't have a full-time minister these days. It's like a circuit rider or somebody that comes in from Charleston or somewhere else. So all aspects of a small town, it could suffer when the economy goes down, including religion.
They still have a post office in Allendale, though, right?
Yes, they do. 29810. I'll always remember.
Well, you know, the institutions that help hold rural communities together. You talked earlier about the merged high schools, but
right.
It used to be every little town had their high school, which was the center of activity.
Right.
Those began to disappear in the 50s. That's when mm-hmm. Jimmy Burns began merging the
right.
to create one high school mm-hmm. in the county and that kind of thing. Creating those great farm-to-market roads was another.
Exactly.
All of a sudden, you could not just take your produce to Charleston or Orangeburg or whatever your closest.
Right.
You could also get out of town.
Right, in a hurry.
And some of the denominational support for small churches began to disappear. And and the post offices began to be closed.
Yes, it did. You know, places like Allendale still have one. But even like Swallow Savannah, the church itself was originally down on the Savannah River. It's one of the oldest churches in the state. And it moved inland when the railroad came through from basically Savannah coming up to Augusta, mm-hmm. Charleston over to Augusta. They merged there at Fairfax mm-hmm. and in Allendale County. And so the church moved inland to high ground, as mm-hmm. they say, to get the railroad through there. So it's got a great history, and I always thought it was a beautiful name. This book, Swallow Savannah, they always say if you're going to write a book, you know, write what you know. Mm-hmm. And so my first book, I sat down and I wrote what I know, and I know about what it's like to grow up in a small town in rural South Carolina in the 50s and 60s during segregation mm-hmm. and also next door to the Savannah River plant, which we call the bomb plant. And so that's what this book is based on. Now, to a great historian like you, people like me are like your worst nightmare mm-hmm. because we take history and then we lie about it, is what fiction really is. It's a license to lie. But what I've done in my books, I take factual history of the times, and then I lay a story, a mystery, a love story, all these things that you need in there to make a pretty interesting story. And with Swallow Savannah, when it came out, people who read it, they put the book down, and usually people would read it in a day or two, and then they would close the last page, and they would look at me and they would say, did this really happen? And I would say, coulda. The book did well. You know, I sold some. I did a lot of signings, and people got interested. But what they do when you write a book, when you finish, they say, okay, write another one. And you go, whew, I just finished that one. Mm-hmm. But I sat down and I wrote Sister Santee, which is my second novel. And it's set in the 70s and 80s here in South Carolina in the Santee Cooper area of the state. Mm-hmm. And this actually, again, write what you know. This book opens in the state mental hospital on Bull Street. Now, anybody who grew up or lived in South Carolina knows what Bull Street means. Yeah. Is the large, archaic, dungeonous mental institution down on Bull Street here in Columbia. I worked there for about 8 months, and I never thought I would use that. But when I sat down to write, this character in this book, Maceo Mazique, is a patient there who escapes, and the plot goes on from there. And it also deals with the Santee Cooper power authority. So anyway, but it's also a wild and crazy ride through South Carolina. I was in the Air Force Reserve. I actually served 20 years, and mostly in Charleston, C-141s. Mm-hmm. And there's a character in this book that's a pilot for the reserves, and he gets a little off track in his life, and he ends up stealing a C-141, which I can tell you right away, the Air Force frowns on that. And this is also during the time of Hugo. So it's got a lot of plot lines in it. My editors tell me I have so much going on in my books that you know, and then it all comes together at the end. And they say, "How do you do that?" And I say, "I don't know."
And these are all published by the Evening Post.
They are. And I want to give a plug. Evening Post Books is a small niche boutique, if you will, mm-hmm. Publisher. The Post and Courier is a family-owned newspaper, mm-hmm. one of the last in the country. And they decided that they needed to develop a division, a book division, to publish local authors about local topics. That's a simple mission. Books that probably would otherwise not get published. So we do a lot of historical stuff. My book, Swallow Savannah, was their very first venture. I've now written a third novel. It's called Salkehatchie Soup, and it comes out in March 2nd. And it is in the 90s and early 2000s. It's set back over in that unknown part of the state along the Salkehatchie River, which most people don't even know exists. It's hard to find. Mm-hmm. If you go looking for the Salkehatchie, it's really a muddy swamp that runs down the left groin of South Carolina. Mm-hmm. But its headwaters are right up at the Savannah River plant. And again, a lot of crazy characters and a lot of things going on, but it's an interesting topic.
One thing you mentioned earlier, you're talking about your stint at your job at the state hospital.
Yes.
That expression, going to Bull Street,
right.
Or he needs to go to Bull
right.
Street, is disappearing because it's no longer a valid.
I went through there recently. Well, I'll say a year or so ago, and it was just a ghost town. They closed it down, emptied it out, and I think it's been sold now for real estate. But I walked through there, and it was completely empty. But there are a lot of ghosts in there, Walter. And I was happy to get out of there when I did. I didn't know that those memories and those visions and all that would come up again later in a book. My job as an admitting clerk was when patients were brought in. A lot of times these patients were brought in, like my character in this book, Sister Santee, in chains. I mean, you know, they would be like Horry County deputies would bring somebody in that they'd chase through the swamp all night and, you know, beaten up and put in chains and brought them in. And then they would bring them into me, and I was a 20-year-old kid. And this would be at night sometimes. And they would bring them in, take all the chains off, hand me some paperwork, and they would leave. And I'd be sitting there faced with this person who I didn't know how sane they were at the time. But it was quite frightening at times. Or
let me ask you, no documentation? No.
Well, they had to have a court order back then. They had to have a judge sign it.
Okay.
But, you know, a lot of judges were friends of friends, and you could get Aunt Lucy locked up if you really wanted to, basically.
Can't do that.
Can't do that anymore, right.
Yeah.
So part of my job was to take whatever personal effects these people had in their pockets and on their person and, you know, log them in, and we would put them away. But, I mean, people would have, like, you know, the Book of Revelation, you know, torn up in little strips mm-hmm. of paper and just all manner of odd things, chicken bones and stuff in their pockets. But it all made for interesting writing when I went to do it. The real sad part of my memories there were that these people were not – there was no answer to their problems. Most of them were warehoused for many years. It was sad, very sad.
You read two of your favorite gifts from baptized and Sweet Tea, which, by the way, we did mention won a Benjamin Franklin Award from independent booksellers.
Yes, I went to New York to pick up that award. It was very nice. It was deemed the best gift book in the country, a gold medal this past year.
Which obviously brought about another printing.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. This has been a great book because it just gives me an opportunity to talk to people about so many things in their lives that touch different people.
Well, one of your columns that really grabbed me, and I'm going to read, is called Going Home for Funerals.
Oh, yeah.
Because at our age, we do this a lot more than we used to. The church was much smaller than I remembered, but then again, everything seems that way when you go home for funerals. Separated by 90 miles in more than 40 years, visits to this little town in the pine forests of South Carolina always bring back memories of a youth freckled with optimism and splashed with the sunshine of tomorrow. Now it's an all too often trek back to pay respects to those who made it that way. Last week, the Little Episcopal Church was packed for Margaret Boylston, a beloved teacher and role model for a generation of post-war babies. At 91, she had lived the small-town life to its fullest, raising two boys in a high school full of would-be world changers. Some did, some didn't. But everyone came back to say how much they cared for the lady who helped us along the way. As we gathered, gray-haired and balding, we realized life was coming full circle, that this was not the last time we'd meet under the moss-draped oaks of Swallow Savannah Cemetery to leave behind another memory. We laughed that we had to stop meeting like this, but solemnly agreed that it would only get worse in the years to come. The world we knew had changed for better or worse, and the people who lived down the street and around the corner, the ones who towered above our lives, gave us strength and hope, were slowly but surely slipping away. In her last years, I remember my own mother saying, "You don't realize you're old until you look around and there's no one who remembers you as a child." That reality becomes more chilling with each service I attend. Afterwards, between bites of triangle sandwiches and chicken wings, we milled around Mrs. Boylston's house as if she might be sitting in the next room, waiting to talk to us. As a drama teacher, she taught us how to pretend. And so we did, as we always do when we come home, wishing it was still the way it was. But of course, it's not. Strangers live in the house where I was born. The best fields are overgrown. The high school is a middle school, and the football stadium that looms so large on Friday nights looks small and insignificant. Meanwhile, a log-in truck rumbles by, dropping the crumbling cargo on the highway. Stores that once flourished are closed, and Main Street is quiet except for a freight train that drags slowly through town. Traces of our youth still exist, but they are rusted and sag under the weight of time and distance. Only the smiles that spread across familiar faces make you feel like you're home again, at least for a while, until we gather again. Of course, folks would have had to read the whole collection of essays to know when you talk about the house that where you were born, because you were born at home.
I was.
And thinking about downtown Allendale, where literally there are stores that have fallen in and are covered with, the ruins are covered with kudzu. Mm-hmm. And for a while after the county courthouse burned, the courthouse was a collection of trailer pods.
Yes. It's very sad. And I think anybody, well, you know, even if they go back to where they grew up, everything's smaller than you imagine when you were a child. I remember right next to that courthouse was our library. And I used to go in there as a small boy. I remember summer mornings when it was still cool and the dew was still on the ground, and we would go into this building, and it was still kind of cool because it was stone. Mm-hmm. And there was this huge picture, the silhouette artist.
Carew Rice
had done. And he's from that area. And it was, I just remember it was of a little boy sitting under a tree, a moss-draped tree, reading a book. So many years later, I was actually driving back. I'd covered the Masters in Augusta, and I was headed to Hilton Head for the Heritage. And I came through Allendale on the way down, and I said, I'm going to stop in there and take a look at that picture that I remember. And I walked in, and I looked, and I couldn't find it. And I asked a lady who worked there, what happened to it? She says, oh, it's in this room over here. And she took me in. And, of course, it was a 4x2 picture, you know, that I remembered being 10x8 or whatever. But that's what time does to you and your memories.
This is Walter Edgar's Journal. Today's program is a rebroadcast of a 2013 interview with the late journalist and author Ken Berger, and it is part of our continuing series celebrating Walter Edgar's Journal at 21.
I hear you talking about time. You don't get sad. You're smiling.
No. I think it's all part of the, you know, it's all part of life, Walter. It's you know, I'm feel lucky to have these memories, to have grown up where I did, when I did. Not that you have a choice, mm-hmm. but you have to appreciate, you know, what you had and what turned you into what you are. Mrs. Ballston, for instance, that column you just read, we were so fortunate there to have great teachers. You know, and when you pull out and you look at where you grew up, and I say that I grew up behind the Pine Curtain, that it was, you know, miles and miles and millions of pine trees out there. We had a school superintendent when I was growing up who used to trek to Winthrop College every spring and recruit and hire young women teachers who were graduating and they were single, and to talk them into coming to Allendale to teach for a year. And then he would do his best to get them married off to the farmers in the area so that they would stay. So we had a number of people like that. And they were just – we had exceptional teachers back in the 50s and 60s at Allendale Fairfax class of 67. Thank you very much.
Did you play football there?
I played a little. I was in the team picture twice. But I didn't get on the field very much. I was not an athlete. And you know, I tell people if I'd known I was going to grow up to be a sports writer for most of my career, I would have, you know, tried harder and paid more attention. But for, you know, the truth of the matter is most people are like me, and you may have been a hero, but I wasn't in sports. And it's just something that, you know, and especially in a small town in the South, it's like a rite of passage. Mm-hmm. Everybody, you have to go out for football mm-hmm. and get your brains beat in. And then once you've done that, you can go back to the band where you belong. I was in the band.
I know you were on the Savannah River, but why'd you become a bulldog instead of a gamecock or a tiger?
That's interesting. When I was coming out of high school, I was sentenced to 2 years at Anderson Junior College for academic misdemeanors in high school. My major crime was not having a comma in my SAT score. We didn't know it was that important. I made like 900 on it. But I went to Anderson, which I didn't know where Anderson was. I just wanted to get out of Allendale. I went there for 2 years. And because of the location of Anderson, I had a advisor on the newspaper there at the junior college who went to Georgia, knew about its journalism school, and encouraged me to take a look at it. And, you know, I tell people I'm from South Carolina, but I studied abroad at the University of Georgia. And then I came back. It was a great place to go to school. Not a good time.
Well, I think you mentioned somewhere you were fairly old in terms of being maybe a teenager before you really got much out of the county, right?
Oh, well, I mean, right. I didn't see Columbia until I was – my brother, I have an older brother who's 7 years older, Frank, and he went to Carolina in 1961. Okay. So that was the first time I'd seen Columbia. My mother was from Bamberg. My father was a transplant from Maryland. They had met in Washington. But he had, you know, in World War II, he was a tank commander for Patton in World War II. So when the war was over, he came back to South Carolina. My brother had been born. And so my parents didn't go to college. So we didn't have these connections to go around the state. I mean, they were hardworking people. Mm-hmm. And we just didn't venture far from home. So I really had, you know, I read the state newspaper growing up, and I was fascinated by the datelines of these stories and where these places were, that somebody might actually pay you money to go to these places and write about things. So that's really how I got hooked into journalism. And as a young boy, I like to write. I've always loved to write, and it's always come easy for me. I didn't know it was hard until later when people told me that it's hard for them, but I just love to write. I can sit down and write about anything, anytime, and it's I now speak to students about writing, and one of the things I tell them, Walter, is that in order to be a good writer, you need to be fearless. You have to sit down with the intention of writing something good. I always feel that whenever I sit down, it's going to turn out well. Mm-hmm. So, and the newspaper business is the greatest teacher for writing because of our deadlines and our space conditions. Like I say, these columns in this book are 500 words because I would write for that hole down the left-hand side of the page.
It's harder to write short than it is long.
Mark Twain said, I would have written you a shorter letter, but I didn't have time. and it's true. And then do it on deadline at night in a press box where they're cutting the lights out and it's cold. What it does is it puts a value on every word. And you have to go back and look at them anew. I had a professor at Georgia who was one of my best professors. And basically, he gave us an assignment, told us to write 1,000 words, gave us all the facts and stuff. And we wrote it. And then we came back in, and he gave it right back to us and said, cut it in half. And you got 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And you know, we were still on typewriters back then. So we would do that. And then we would say, oh, gosh, take that out, take this out. And then we would turn it in, and he would hand it right back to us again, like a good city editor in mm-hmm. a newsroom, and say, cut it in half again. So you're down from 1,000 to 500 to 250 words, and that really makes you pay attention to what you can use and what you can't use and how important those words were when you wrote them and how unimportant they are when you have to put a value on them. Mm-hmm. So it's a great way to learn how to write tight.
Ken, how about reading us one more of your, I'm going to call them memoirs, or your your columns from Baptized in Sweet Tea?
I would love to read this one. It's called The Poetry of College Football.
Or The Poetry of College Football.
And this was actually written in 2008, right at the beginning of the season. It's in August. So we all know what the anticipation is right before the football season starts in South Carolina. And it goes like this. I know you're out there clutching your season tickets, counting the days, deciding what to wear, wondering if it'll be hot or cold, if it will rain, waiting somewhat impatiently for the college football season to finally begin. From big towns and small, all at once, you'll emerge from the back roads onto the interstates like migrating herds, dogged, determined, flying the colors, caravans of cars and vans, stocked to the gills with potato salad and fried chicken, sweet tea by the gallon, soft drinks, hard drinks, and just enough deviled eggs to go around twice. It's an ageless procession of frat boys and pretty girls, sorority sisters, old and young, near and dear, distinguished alums, loudmouth louts, children in cheerleader uniforms, drunks in T-shirts and ties, tossing footballs and talking trash. Then, with folding chairs tightly circled in dusty lots and grassy fields, perfectly parked, acre upon endless acre, color-coordinated, anxious and antsy, fiddling with satellite dishes and scraping paper plates while waiting for shadows to fall and stadium lights to illuminate the dark sky, officially turning game day into night. Once inside, stacked to the stars, elbow to elbow, buying programs and popcorn, stepping over each other, excuse me, please and thank you. What a night, what a sight. Sure hope the home team wins. And they might, or not, depending on the truth and rumors about sophomore tackles and red shirt quarterbacks and what the coach had to say about so-and-so last week. A few boos for the visiting varmints, jumping jacks and leg lifts, practice punts that hang high in the lights, falling softly onto the cool, wet grass, chewed up by the cleats of cutting cornerbacks, double-checking coverage, assignments, and girlfriends gabbing in the grandstands. Then down the hill and through the tunnel they come, smoke and cannon fire, combined to thrill and quicken pulses, gladiators in the arena, trotting, taunting, to the beat of a drum major, high-stepping, bringing the band and its audience to a chilling crescendo. A wash in the ebb and flow, a touchdown here, a field goal there, the game unfolds. The good, the bad, the better or worse, damn the luck and the referees, not to mention the tailback who fumbled on the one. Screaming helps, but you've got to pee. Too much sweet tea, maybe later, in the second half, when the lines aren't long, when the only true believers are left, holding hands, singing alma maters in the rain. Win or lose, the traffic's tough, sitting still, inching nowhere, as the coach comes on the radio, explaining himself, finding victory in defeat, looking ahead to next week, next year, when things will be better or worse, he really doesn't know. But it's all brought to you by somebody's hot dog chili, perfect for tailgating, and the local bank that loves the home team, and you, the faithful fan, whose family's needs are always met by a former field goal kicker turned insurance salesman. In the aftermath comes analysis, talk of change, pain, promise, and passion for the game, the team, the common cause. Back home, the flags are stowed and pretty pennants put away for another day of hope and heartbreak in the precious hours of fun, fashion, and fancy called college football.
And especially college football in South Carolina.
In South Carolina, absolutely.
Okay. Ken Berger, I hate to say this, but Alfred's giving me the wind-up sign. Any last words for our listeners before we sign off?
Well, I just want to say that what a privilege it's been and how lucky I am to have been a writer in South Carolina, to have made a living as a writer, to be able to publish these books. My publisher would kill me if I didn't say they're for sale at bookstores around the state. It's been an honor to be on with Walter Edgar.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know I did. I didn't grow up in a small southern town, but I spent a lot of time with cousins in small southern towns. And this was a trip back in time for me, as it obviously was for Ken. But I think one of the important things that I learned by having Ken Berger in the studio with me today is, while it's nostalgic, it was not a sad journey. It was a happy journey. Even talking about going to a funeral and talking with his friends who are gray-haired or in some cases getting bald, it was happy. A sad occasion, but they were all happy sharing memories of a favorite teacher or a prank or when they take off their seersucker suits and above all those 57 Bel Air Chevrolets. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Today's program was a rebroadcast of a 2013 interview with the late journalist and author Ken Berger, and it is part of our continuing series celebrating Walter Edgar's journal at 21.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETB Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.